This court has consistently stressed that the ability of an agency to invoke a Glomar rationale for declining to provide any documents or even search for documents is a rather narrow one. In Wolf, this court, for example, stressed that the agency has the burden of establishing that the existence vel non fits within the exemption that's being invoked. In the Epic case that both parties have cited to, the Environmental Protection and Information Center case, the court stressed the agency affidavits must specify with reasonable specificity rather than conclusory statements why every single record that may be responsive to the request falls within an exemption, and that that statement cannot be called into question by contradictory evidence. In the ACLU case that this court recently decided involving the drone strike issue and the invocation of Exemption 1, which we referred the court to as a recent authority, the court again stressed that the entire Glomar concept is what the court referred to as a judicial construct that can be invoked only when a categorical rule would clearly establish that no records fall outside of an exemption claim. We respectfully submit, as we've set forth in the briefs, that by any reasonable yardstick, that very strict test has not been satisfied in this case. And we make that argument, I think, based upon a number of materials that are in the record. And with the court's permission, I will focus on those aspects of the record that we think are most compelling in that regard. In our view, and I've looked through the appendix again, there is literally one paragraph in the entire record. This is at Joint Appendix page 386, in which the government purported to explain why a Glomar rationale was appropriate here. And in fact, within that paragraph, there is, I think, a single sentence, because the first part of the paragraph, which is paragraph 10, simply repeats what a Glomar response is. And then there's a single sentence which states that, quote, the requested issue expressly asked for records that, if they existed, would have revealed that the individuals named in the request were being or had been investigated by NIH for some alleged wrongdoing, and such information is protected from release by Exemption 6 and 7C of the FOIA. Aside from the fact that that's essentially a misstatement of law, because this court's cases also require that even in a Glomar situation, there must be some discussion of the countervailing public interest, even if names are disclosed, it's simply an inaccurate statement. And that's problematic because not only was the agency's rationale in the declaration erroneous, but essentially this rationale was repeated as the rationale for the district court's ruling. And if you look at page 480 of the joint appendix, in the middle of the page, the district court says, quote, there is no question that a response from the agency acknowledging the existence of the records and processing the FOIA request further would confirm that these three individuals were being or had been investigated. And as we set forth in the briefs, and we'll just sort of reemphasize, that's simply an inaccurate statement. We've given a number of hypothetical examples of records that could exist, and bless you, Your Honor, and we're in the hypothetical category because since nobody searched for documents, we simply don't know.
Well, here's a way in which I wonder if there's just kind of a two ships passing in the night quality in this case, because if you look at the way that you framed your request, it seeks investigative reports, preliminary notes, emails, etc., related to, and you focused understandably on related to because that's expansive, but related to NIH investigations into complaints. And so in some way, one way to read the request is it presupposes the existence of an investigation, and you want documents that are related to the investigation. And if you look at it that way, then there is something to what's being said here, because disclosure would tell you that there, in fact, was an investigation.
Yeah.
So isn't it a consequence of the way that you worded your request?
I think I agree, Your Honor, that the request could be subject to an interpretation that if you read it as narrowly as you conceivably could, would get you into the second stage of a balancing is in fact there a sufficient public interest to outweigh releasing even records that might be considered investigatory?
I'm not sure I'm reading it narrowly. It seems like I'm reading it literally because it uses the word investigation.
Well, but again, what we've said is, and I think we draw support for this proposition from the court's ruling in the Nation case as well as others, that request should be read in a way which is liberally construed and which is consistent with the requester's interest in getting as much information as reasonable. And again, as Your Honor has suggested, we focused on the related to, in our view, and I don't think the government's disputed this, related to, for example, would mean they never even received the request. Related to would mean we received the request, but we saw that it was submitted to the United States Department of Agriculture, and therefore we decided to put it in a category of doing nothing. Related to could mean, we simply got a CC to the head of NIH, and therefore we didn't process. Related to can mean...
We can ask the government this, but I wonder if they would say that none of that actually fits within the scope of the request because none of that is related to an investigation. Because there's no investigation. When there's no response, when you didn't even receive it, there's just not an investigation.
Well, and Your Honor, I guess the way we've viewed it and what we've argued, and I don't think the government, at least to this point, has disagreed, because we made this argument in our opening brief. We made quite clear, and we included actually in our opening brief on page 27, a series of examples which are similar to what I just gave, that in fact that would be considered within the context of this request, and the government didn't disagree with that. We could see what they have to say today. I would respectfully suggest that if they wanted to disagree with that as a reasonable reading of the request, they should have done that in the briefing, and I think that's problematic because we could have responded. But I do think that related to all investigations includes refusals to investigate or even to acknowledge that they received the request. And as Your Honor knows, we've referred to the statement of material facts, which we think highlights not only conclusory problems, but also internally contradictory ones, where we said NIH received the request from the plaintiff, and they denied that. They said there's no evidence that they even received the request. And then two paragraphs later, they repeated the same denial. So if their position is that they never received the request, then denying that they have any information relating to whether or not a request received, I would respectfully submit that wouldn't reflect anything that would bear on anyone's personal privacy either. And so to me, this is the kind of situation where the ship's passing in the night. I agree on this level. Could the request have been framed somewhat differently? Perhaps. Has the government responded in a way that would have foreclosed this amount of litigation over this issue? Reasonably, I respectfully submit they could have. If they had come in and said, well, we're going to read your request in the following fashion early on, then either we could have agreed as to how they would process the request or any records relating to how PETA's complaint was addressed. That's basically what the plaintiff was interested in. They wanted to know, and 6 years later, 7 years later, they submit a detailed inquiry to the agency, and 7 years later, they don't have any response. They have no idea what actually even happened to the request that they submitted to NIH. On the other hand, USDA, which had the same complaint and the same request for material, not only gave PETA its complaint back, but also provided, as Your Honor knows, a detailed description of USDA's evaluation of essentially the same Animal Welfare Act violations that NIH had not responded
to. Does the fact that USDA chose to respond in a particular way dictate how another agency responds?
It doesn't dictate it, Your Honor, but I think what it reflects are two things which are relevant here. One is that when you're talking about the public interest, the fact and the balancing test, the fact that you have two analogous agencies, this is not like a situation with the CIA and Office of Personnel Management as in one of the cases. This is two analogous agencies. If anything, USDA has more authority, generally speaking, over Animal Welfare Act issues than NIH does. And one agency not only is able to provide acknowledgement of a request, of a complaint, but also provide detailed information about its evaluation and even its conclusion that the complaint was valid. So you have another agency which not only fails to respond in any way to the request, invokes a Glomar response, but 7 years later, we have no idea what the agency's analysis was. I think that relates to the public interest part of the equation, certainly. Why do we have two agencies acting in diametrically different fashions with the same basic kind of statutory and regulatory, you know, issues before them. I think that's a core public interest issue. But I don't think it also goes directly to the privacy part of the balance. And I think on this issue, this is an important, I think, aspect of our position to crystallize. The government keeps talking a lot about those cases involving waiver issues. Frequently, when they talk about Wolf, they talk about other cases. Those cases deal with the question as to whether or not the government has released the precise piece of information that it's claiming an exemption for. And so therefore, the court's inquiry in those contexts, understandably, relates to whether or not there has been a waiver of the right to invoke an exemption as to those specific pieces of information. So, for example, in Wolf, the court decided the agency had waived this to one piece of information, but not as to another. Our argument in this case is somewhat different than that. Argument in this case is that given the amount of information that's available, including, as Your Honor referred to, the USDA's release of information on the very subject that the NIH invoked the Glomar analysis for, that in fact the privacy interest is substantially diminished, at least to the point of requiring some kind of actual balancing between the nature of the materials that are at issue and, on the other hand, the public interest, and whether the privacy interest can be adequately minimized to support the release of other documents. And so,
on the privacy interest, I think you're assuming that if the request in fact encompasses the documents that relate to whether a complaint was received, and bracket for one moment the interpretation on which that's not equal to the scope of the request.
Yes, Your Honor.
But if the request does encompass that, that there's no privacy interest at all in acknowledging the receipt of the complaint. And I wonder if that's true, because it does seem like there's a privacy interest in some measure, because at that point we know that there's been a complaint lodged against the person.
Well, and again, Your Honor, in this case, we have the problematic, and I would submit, you know, again, quintessentially contradictory evidence in the record where the agency denied even receiving a complaint. So we have that problem here, which I think we're at least entitled to explore further. Keep in mind, we were cut off at the pass in this case. District Court granted summary judgment.
I guess I was asking a more abstract question, which is just as a general matter, the receipt of a complaint does seem to implicate some level of privacy interest.
Well, I would say I would agree with Your Honor some level, but I think we have a situation here where we have not only the USDA having released the same complaint with all this information in it. As we indicated, we had Auburn University in multiple parts of the record. I mean, just to give you some of the citations, we had released by USDA of not only the complaint and its own analysis, and that's pages 174 through 76. 244 through 46, 265 through 323. We also had multiple releases from Auburn University, pages 172 of the joint appendix, and really sort of a press release by Auburn University that these were the researchers who were conducting the very research that's discussed by the USDA. So I would grant, Your Honor, that if you want to say there's some marginal privacy interest, when NIH says, here's the same complaint that USDA released, I don't think that really ultimately undercuts our case in any considerable way. And on that score, if I could just say, make a point, I think the district court recognized that in an oblique way. There's a reference in the district court to the USDA's release, and the district court judge refers to non-authenticated documents about USDA's release. And honestly, I'm just not sure what that means. This wasn't a trial. We weren't even at a stage where we could explore any of the factual assertions. The government never disputed that the USDA had released the document, that the complaint, and that it was a matter of public record as a result of USDA's release. Rather, they simply took the narrow categorical position that USDA's release doesn't mean, under a waiver theory, that NIH cannot invoke an exemption claim.
Isn't a complaint something significantly different than investigation?
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is something significantly different, and I think that I think this case highlights the importance of that. So, if there's a complaint submitted and no investigation is ever undertaken, and we simply are trying to find out what the agency's procedure is for processing the complaint, That seems to me to highlight a huge public interest and very minimal privacy interest. And just as an example...
But if I'm understanding your argument, you're relying upon the fact that there was public knowledge of a complaint to say that there's a diminished privacy interest in the fact of an investigation or whether or not the investigation is occurring. And that doesn't seem to me to follow. They seem to be very different as touches upon privacy interests.
Your Honor, if I could give two responses. One, I think we have two separate aspects of concern here. One is, did they even receive the complaint, and then did they do anything with the complaint? We have a denial of receipt, and we have a series of questions as to whether or not they simply took the complaint and said, we'll put this on the shelf because USDA has received this complaint, or we're going to put this complaint aside because we have budget problems. So that's a critical category of information that we want, that we would be interested in, that we think entitled to, irrespective of whether they ever did an investigation. The second question about whether or not there are any investigatory records, we respectfully submit, requires some kind of balancing analysis. I mean, we've suggested, for example, that the complaint in this case raised issues not only about particular researches at Auburn, but about Auburn as a whole and its overall oversight of Animal Welfare Act compliance issues, and particularly this entity called, it's an IOCUC, as referred to it in the records, the Institutional Animal Care and Use Committee, and the extent to which it actually exercised its statutory responsibilities. That's one of the things that USDA said in its analysis of the same complaint. It had serious concerns with the IOCUC, if I could be permitted to use that for time, its analysis. So if you released a series of records here which only related to the IOCUC's performance of its duties and did not provide any information about individuals and deleted all the names of the individuals, you would still be providing information that would be of great value to the public, but would not, we respectfully submit, provide for any serious privacy invasion. So I think, Your Honor, we have two levels of argument, and as to both of them, we respectfully submit that there should be a remand in this case so we could explore some of these issues, find out what the agency actually has in its possession, and determine whether or not there should be at least a balancing as to some category of information. And along those lines, I think the court's recent decision in the drone strike case, which was an Exemption 1 case, and many of the court's cases, I think most of them, which have upheld any kind of Glomar rationale, have done so in a national security context. Even in that case, the court said, given the threshold and the early stage we're at, let's at least have the district court make some evaluation of what's out there. We may be able to have a Glomar invocation for some category of information, and for some other categories of information, it may well not be appropriate. And I would respectfully submit that we're at a stage in this case where exactly the same kind of analysis may be appropriate. On remand, if the government can come in and say, well, we've got this category of records related to individuals, we've got this category relating to the IOCUC, we've got this category relating to Auburn as a whole, and we've got this category relating to whether or not we even considered the complaint to be received, then I think the district court would be in a position to evaluate, in some kind of a more knowledgeable and informed way, whether or not we have a right to any of the information, and even as to whether or not a Glomar rationale could be invoked as to some, perhaps even all, but certainly some of the information. But I think by virtue of how the district court judge allowed this case to be resolved at such an extraordinarily early stage, we just didn't have that opportunity. And if I could just make one, I'm sorry, I just realized I'm way over my time. So I will rest at this point. Thank you, Your Honor.
I was going to let you go ahead. You said you had one more point.
I think I gave you my conclusion.
Okay. Ms. Breswell.
Good morning, Your Honors. The district court in this case correctly upheld NIH's Glomar response to a request for investigatory records on specifically named individuals when neither NIH nor the individuals had acknowledged ever publicly acknowledged the existence of such an investigation. Any other response would have, in fact, revealed the very information sought to be protected with respect to the Glomar response. I think it's important to focus on the language of the request, Your Honor, as you did, because, in fact, the language is very narrow and very specific. It says that they wanted all information related to all NIH investigations, not Auburn University investigations, not USDA investigations, NIH investigations, into complaints filed with respect to three specifically named individuals. The government took the requester at its word. The government's often accused of not looking at a FOIA request carefully as to what's been said, and now PETA wants the government to just take the FOIA request that they wish they had written instead of the one they actually wrote.
So on the question of documents concerning whether you received the complaint, do you construe a document concerning whether you received the complaint to be within the scope of this request, or do you construe it to be without the scope of the request because it doesn't deal with an investigation?
I think just a document by itself, if it did not trigger an investigation, is not within the scope of this request. And if PETA wanted to know whether or not NIH received its complaint, all it had to do is ask in this request. Or it could have sent an email to NIH, as it's done in the past, asking.
We know now, it sounds like, that PETA believes that it all wanted documents that related to whether the request was ever received by NIH. You construe the request as not encompassing that.
Absolutely not.
How should they have reframed it?
They should have simply, they could have said related to all NIH complaints and investigations into the activities of these specific researchers at Auburn University. Now, that does not mean that they would not have received a Glomar response. I mean, this court in the Beck case upheld a Glomar response when a request was made for complaints regarding DEA agents. So while the privacy interest in a complaint is different than the privacy interest in being the target of an investigation, there is still a privacy interest in having complaints made about you. And therefore, I'm not at all prepared to say that there would not have been a Glomar response if they had included the word complaint. But they
There's
don't.
There's a privacy interest about the receipt of the complaint, then why did you respond to the statement of material facts?
Your Honor, that was probably not as artfully done as it should have been, because in order to be consistent with the Glomar, we should have simply refused to confirm or deny that. But in fact, that statement was made based on the facts that were available to the agency and to me. That's the only response I can give you in terms of that response. But I think the issue of the complaint and whether or not it was received, frankly, is a red herring here. This case specifically asks for investigatory records regarding three specifically named individuals. And this court has made amply clear that targets of investigations have substantial privacy interests, and that Glomar response is entirely appropriate in order to protect those interests unless there is an overriding public interest in the documents that have been requested. And although not mentioned in the argument, I just want to emphasize that the fact that the request was on records for three individuals, which is something that PETA stressed in their brief, does not eviscerate the government's ability to assert a Glomar response. In fact, this court's decision in Roth is almost directly similar, because in Roth there was a request for information on four individuals. The agency asserted a Glomar response, and the only reason that this court set aside the Glomar response was because of an overriding public interest in allowing an inmate on death row to get access to information that might exonerate him from the murders. So the fact that information was sought on three individuals does not mean that the government is not entitled to assert a Glomar response. And I think it's important to note that when PETA talks about the public interest involved in this case, that there was a request that was properly framed that did not engender a Glomar response that met PETA's concerns about knowing what the government is up to, quote unquote. And that was their first request. When they sent a request to the Office of Law Animal Welfare, Laboratory Animal Welfare, OLAW, at NIH, and they asked for all records, all OLAW records on Auburn University. And as NIH demonstrated in the service declaration, OLAW is the NIH entity that investigates allegations of abuse against laboratory animals. That's at Joint Appendix 401. There was an acknowledgement that records existed, records were processed, and records were released. So the district court knows this in an opinion that to the extent that there's a public interest in knowing what OLAW is doing in terms of its activities with respect to Auburn University, that public interest arguably was met with the release in the first case. With respect to
So in this case, if the request had not named the specific individuals but in other respects is the same request, there would be no Glomar response.
If they had asked for records, agency records on Auburn University, there would not have been a Glomar response. There wasn't one with that type of request the first time around because it didn't identify specific individuals. This is really a problem of the writing of a FOIA request. How the FOIA request was written was written such that the agency had no choice but to Glomar. If it had been written differently, as it was the first time around, then there would not have been a Glomar response. There might well have been redactions in order to protect privacy interests under Exemption 6 or 7C. There would not have been a Glomar response if they just requested records concerning Auburn University, which would have met their need to find out what the government was doing with respect to Auburn University. With respect to the public interest, the PETA has argued that the government has made no mention in the record anywhere as to the rationale or any explanation of considering the public interest. That's absolutely incorrect. At Joint Appendix 350, which is the administrative appeal in this case, that was sent back to PETA in response to its appeal regarding the Glomar response, the government specifically discussed the Glomar response and said that once a privacy interest has been identified, the analysis shifts to the public interest, if any, in disclosure of the requested information, that only a public interest that outweighs the privacy interest would require the information to be disclosed. And then the NIH went on to say, the burden of establishing that disclosure would serve the public interest is on the requester. In this context, it should be noted that the work of the named researchers has received support from non-federal as well as federal sources. PETA offered no proof that allegations and investigations, if any, of violations of animal welfare policy involved federal funding. Therefore, PETA has failed to show that disclosure of the requested information, if it existed, would shed light on the agency's performance of its statutory duty or there is a public interest in disclosure. So the agency very specifically addressed the issue of public interest, and this goes to PETA's argument that there's a public interest in ensuring that tax dollars are not misused. As you note in what I just read, there's nothing that indicated that PETA's complaints were targeted towards activities that were being done with respect to public funding. And the only other public interest that PETA identified for the district court was simply that it has an interest in knowing what OLAW does with respect to complaints made concerning abuse of animals. And as I stated earlier, that public interest was served with respect to the response to their first request, asking for records on Auburn University.
So you don't disagree that that is a valid public interest that should be taken into account in the balancing? Because it seems to me that there's been some suggestion that there's no public interest in this case at all.
No, I certainly don't think that's what we meant to convey. There's a public interest in knowing that OLAW is in fact investigating complaints, that it is carrying out its duties, but just because you identify a public interest does not mean it's an overriding public interest. And I think our point here is that in order for it to override the public interest in to override the privacy interest that an individual has in being a target of an investigation, which is what their request sought, that's not enough to simply say we need to know what the agency is doing. And finally, with respect to the waiver issue, this court has repeatedly, in the Frugon case and more recently in Moore versus CIA, has said that there is no waiver unless the agency itself makes an official acknowledgement that it has documents. It is absolutely undisputed that NIH has not made any official acknowledgement that it has documents responsive to this request. And PETA's argument that the Department of Agriculture has made a response, I would note that in the Department of Agriculture's documents, certainly at Joint Appendix 244 through 46, it makes no mention of any NIH investigation, only the Department of Agriculture investigation. There's certainly a privacy interest in whether you're being investigated by one agency or by two agencies. So the fact that the Department of Agriculture may or may not have investigated these individuals or did investigate these individuals really has very little bearing on whether or not there has been a waiver by NIH as to whether NIH did an investigation of these individuals. And under this court's clear case law, There has been no waiver by NIH, and certainly Auburn University, which is not even a government entity, cannot, in producing records or saying anything about NIH, that cannot be construed as an official acknowledgement by NIH that it has undertaken an investigation of these three individuals. Consequently, we think the law is clear that there was no waiver here, and that because PETA sought records on investigatory records targeted to three specifically named individuals, and that there is no overriding public interest, there is a substantial privacy interest in being the target of an investigation, that the district court decided this case correctly, and we urge you to affirm it. If there are no questions?
Yes, I do have a question. Ms. Breswell, your opponent imagines a possible investigation by NIH into how the university committee handled the complaint. Now, that wouldn't disclose whether or not there was an investigation of researchers. Why shouldn't NIH at least be asked to look for documents like that?
Because that wasn't their request, Your Honor. Their request was not, please give us any documents you have from Auburn University's.
But we're supposed to construe these in a fashion that is generous, right, to people invoking FOIA. All materials related to all NIH investigations into complaints filed in 2005 to the present regarding these three. Is that an unnatural reading of it to say there might have been an NIH investigation into how this university committee handled the complaints when they received them, and not reaching the issue of any investigation into what the researchers did? That doesn't seem to me to be an unreasonable reading of this. And if it's a reasonable reading, don't we need to give it that?
Your Honor, I think, first of all, the committee is a university committee. It's not an NIH entity.
No, we're talking about the NIH. Is it unimaginable that the NIH would investigate the way the committee responded to a complaint? Doesn't seem to me to be unimaginable.
Well, I don't think, but I think that that's wholly speculative, and I think based on the way this is written, for NIH to say we have any records indicates that NIH had some investigatory interest in these three specific individuals, such that it would even go to the committee and say, did you investigate these three individuals? We're kind of concerned about that. It seems to me that that plainly indicates then that these three individuals are of investigatory interest to NIH, such that it would request to NIH, to the committee, to say, what have you done about these allegations against these individuals? I think that represents a violation of their privacy interests.
When you invoke Glomar, all we can do is speculate, right?
Well, I mean, that's correct, but I think that my response, Your Honor, to if I'm understanding your question correctly, demonstrates that even if NIH had gone to the committee to ask if they had investigated these individuals and there was some sort of records demonstrating that, to acknowledge the existence of those records would impinge on the privacy interests of those three individuals, and there's no overriding public interest that would justify that. Any further questions?
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
Does Mr. Bestheim have any time? All right, why don't you take a minute?
Just to reinforce, I think, Judge Griffith's point, we're speculating because they didn't do any accounting at all of what was in the record. And, in fact, if you look at the request, which is at JA 248, and then you compare that to the complaint that the request refers to, which is PETA's complaint, it starts off with, this is a complaint about Auburn University. And so to the extent that there are records which may reflect Auburn University's responsibility as a whole, we certainly don't have any understanding as to that. And even if there's some marginal privacy interest, this is why there's a balance. If you could remove individual names but also have a discussion of the IACUC or the institution, then you may in fact come out with a balance differently. Critically, in response to the question about whether or not the request was construed to exclude the scenarios that I talked about, the answer by government counsel was, I think it was. We have nothing in the record which supports that. I think on that, at bare minimum, we need at least a remand to explore how this request was construed so you don't have a representation which appears to be an ad hoc one. And in fact, it also undermines, as Judge Griffith's, I think, questioning suggests, the whole directive from Nation Magazine, which is you're supposed to construe these requests in a fashion that facilitates access to what reasonably should be available, not in order to minimize or avoid access. We have a flat-out denial that he received the response, which raises further questions. We think this record is rife with those kinds of concerns. We may end up in a similar place, but I think we're entitled to get additional explanation as to what's out there, how they construed this request, how they applied their whole Glomar analysis, and we just think this is a stage at which the court should not be making those kinds of judgments. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.